This week on Daiwa, we're in Marshall County. Rumors swirl in a small town when a well-liked, friendly woman is brutally murdered while on her way home.
Welcome to Daiwa, the first Iowa-focused true crime podcast, where there's 99 counties and a murder in every one. These are your hosts, Beth LaValle and Allie Tulin.
Marshall County, Beth. Have you been?
I have, yeah. Have you been there?
I also have. It's just like a good central county, yeah. You know?
That's a win-win in my book.
This is a win. So there is this unincorporated community called Green Mountain, meaning it's not governed by anyone. And it's a super small area with just 126 people and was established in 1883 by Shamad Humbab. And Green Mountain was also the site of the Green Mountain train wreck, which was the worst ever in Iowa history. 52 people were killed in the accident on March 21st of 1910. And the lead engine just left the tracks and hit a clay embankment coming to a sudden stop. And so the steel car sliced through the wooden coaches and a smoking car and a ladies' day coach containing many children. I know. No official cause was ever released for the wreck, nor were any charges of neglect made, although the crash did result in the introduction of new safety procedures. Just a fun fact for you. Not really fun.
Yeah, but I mean, there's a silver lining in there.
Yeah, I know.
And I guess we have a more topical fun fact.
Ooh, let's hear
it. The director of the new Top Gun Maverick movie is from Marshalltown, Iowa.
Stop.
I know. It's like I've been telling everyone this. Everyone that I run into. And I've heard the movie's gotten like really good reviews. Have you seen it yet?
I haven't. Yeah, I haven't either.
It's on my list. But same. Armchair Expert said that it's going to revive going to the movies again. It's that kind of movie. So his name is Joseph Kaczynski, and he said he grew up going to the Orpheum Theater and saw the original Top Gun in 1986 when he was just 12 years old. He said in an interview recently, quote, "I remember going to the Orpheum Theater as a kid and seeing all my favorite movies there. So that was about as close as I ever thought I'd get to Hollywood, despite growing up in the town that Gene Seberg came from. It wasn't something that I thought about living in Marshalltown, but I had a great childhood there. What I loved about growing up there is it gave me a great imagination because you had a lot of time to grow up and kind of have an old-fashioned childhood." So Kaczynski earned an engineering degree at Stanford and then an architecture degree at Columbia University after graduating from Marshalltown High School. He shot his first short film in his late 20s and spent the first half of his 30s working on television commercials before directing Tron Legacy. Top Gun Maverick is getting rave reviews with a 96% critic score and a 99% audience score on Rotten Tomatoes.
Dang. Okay. I'm excited.
Does that convince you to see it?
I think so. Also, are you a Gene Seberg fan?
Yeah. Who isn't?
Yeah. Okay. Cool.
What's your favorite Gene Seberg movie?
I think I've only seen the one, which is Breathless. It's like mm-hmm. the French New Wave.
I think yeah. I've actually seen that movie.
Love that they're both from Marshalltown. Mm-hmm. All right, and finally, if you're looking for something fun to do while you're in Marshalltown, there's a, quote, big treehouse that is a 12-level, 55-plus-feet-high treehouse with over 5,000 square feet of floor space, and it has music, electricity, telephone, running water, and more, which is pretty cool. And it was constructed by Mick Jurgensen and family, and you can go visit by appointment and get a guided tour.
That's pretty cool. I think that was also on, like, do you ever see those HDTV shows that just show tree houses that were built?
No. Okay.
So this happened, like, a few years ago where there was, like, a resurgence of, like, really crazy houses that they would show. And so there was, like, a very specific TV show about tree houses. And I think it appeared on one of those shows. I don't know if it was HDTV specific or, like, Discovery Channel or something, but I think it's been featured on TV. Anyways.
Love it.
So this week's murder began in 1893. Grover Cleveland is president. The World's Fair opens in Chicago, Illinois. And in Iowa, the town of Pomeroy is nearly destroyed as a tornado runs through it and 71 people are killed and 200 are injured. The Cherry Sisters perform for the first time, which actually sets a precedent for Fair Comet in the United States. So Addie, Effie, Ella, Lizzie, and Jessie Cherry were sisters from Marion, Iowa, who formed a notorious vaudeville touring act. It was infamous for its poor quality and led audiences to throw vegetables and disrupt performances. And then in 1898, they sued two Iowa newspapers for libel after they printed a scathing review of the act, which eventually went to the Iowa Supreme Court. And then the court ruled in the newspaper's favor and set a precedent for the right to fair comment. That's an extra fun fact for you. But that happened in 1893.
I need to know how bad this performance was.
I hope, I can't confirm this, but I really hope that that was what started, like, throwing tomatoes at people for bad performances.
We'll have to look it up. All right, well, now actually to the murder for today. Our story starts with Anna Weiss, who went by Annie most of the time, so that's what we're going to call her here. She was 22 years old, and her parents were German immigrants. She was highly respected by all who knew her. And her father was Jacob Weiss. He was a well-to-do farmer living near Gladbrook, Iowa. And at the time, Annie was working as hired help on a neighboring farm known as the Russies Place. At 22 years old, she was talking with some men, but was unmarried and wasn't dating anyone seriously. She was friendly with a lot of her parents' neighbors as well as the Russies' neighbors and got along well in the community. Summary of her family, her parents were Marie Elizabeth, Frederica Muller, and Henry Weiss Sr., and she had five siblings. There's Henry Jr., Gus, William, Amos, and Bessie.
On August 26, 1893, Annie had gone to visit Arthur Hill, who she was friends with. Annie left the Hill home at about 10.05 p.m. to go back to the Russies place, which is about 3.5 miles northeast from Green Mountain, Iowa. However, she didn't make it there. Annie was murdered on her way home, and authorities said it happened around 10:15 p.m. and just a half mile from the Russie residence. The Sioux City Journal said, quote, "The scene of the murder and the condition in which the body was found indicate that there must have been a desperate struggle between the assailant and victim, and the girl fought for her life, if not for honor, most valiantly, but against terrible odds. It seems that the murderer had been lying in wait for his victim, hidden from view by a bunch of brush and weeds at the roadside. As the full moon was shining brightly, it enabled him to see the girl plainly as she approached his ambush, and she was probably just opposite him or had barely passed his biting place when he sprang out upon her like a wild beast upon its prey."
The murderer broke a club, or more accurately, a slab of maple wood, while beating her over the head, then changed weapons and used a knife. Her throat was slashed in four places, with one gash penetrating to the spinal bone, almost severing the head. There were 10 other knife stabs in the chest and back.
Henry Russie, the head of the Russie household, heard Annie's screams. He and his son were in the barn tending to a sick horse. They saw the situation, ran, and got the neighbors.
After the neighbors sent telegrams, Sheriff Pence and Coroner David arrived at the scene between 2 and 3 a.m. Sunday morning on August 27th. They began to search for the murderer right away. Some of the evidence they found were, 1, a fistful of hair in Annie's hand, presumably from when her and her murderer were fighting, 2, bloody prints of hands on some fencing, and 3, a broken and bloody club lying on the ground.
They did an autopsy right away. There was a rumor that she was in, quote, a delicate position, unquote, and was done away with by a lover who wanted to be free, but there was no evidence of rape or pregnancy. Sheriff Pence offered a reward of $500 on August 29th for the murderer's apprehension. Later, the governor, Governor Bowles, announced another $1,000 for the arrest and conviction of the killer.
After authorities didn't clue anything together the first night, theories started popping up in the community. The first theory was that Annie had a lover, Bert Eisenhart, who was just 23 years old and either a butcher or a barber. There are two different reports there. He was known to admire Annie and had, quote, pressed his attentions upon her against her will and threatened violence unless she consented to marry him. The Sunday prior to the murder, Annie and him got into an argument. However, the Tuesday before the incident, he bought a ticket for Dubuque and he had not been seen since. On the day of Annie's funeral, Bert Eisenhart was arrested for the murder. On the Sunday before the murder, he came to see her, but she was at church. He gave Annie a ride home, and at the time, she again rejected his suit. This was when Eisenhart then bought a train ticket to Dubuque and disappeared. After Annie's death, newspapers reported that his whereabouts were unknown. However, Eisenhart had a solid alibi for the murder. He worked with a hang crew in Pocahontas County all day on Saturday and spent the night at the farmer's home. Even with this alibi, many people still continued to blame Eisenhart for the murder.
So police continued the investigation. Because there was such a large reward and people were so emotional about this senseless murder, many people tried to solve the murder on their own. Any kind of detective was allowed to investigate in any way that they wanted to. That means that people exhumed Annie's body at least 2 times in 2 months. One other theory that came about was from a private investigator named N.C. Hutchins. He had convinced a local farmer named Samuel R., or Sam, Ernst, that he got a confession out of a 21-year-old, Horace Hill. Annie once worked for Sam, the farmer. Horace was the brother of Arthur Hill, who Annie was visiting the night of the murder. The private detective also said he knew a young woman who went out with Horace Hill and reported that he threatened to kill her if she would not yield to his demands. In mid-October, Hutchins and Ernst charged Horace Hill with murder, restrained him, and took him to the Marshalltown jail. A warrant was sworn out on the word of 2 accusers, and Hill was arraigned. Horace's neighbors believed Hill was innocent so much that they posted his $10,000 bail. He then established a solid alibi and was exonerated. Later, it was reported in the Esterville Daily News that Hutchins, the, quote, alleged detective, was sentenced to 6 months in the penitentiary for kidnapping Hill after he arrested young Horace Hill. He sent an almost illiterate letter to the county attorney asking that Hill be let go and then fled to the state of Indiana. Horace Hill filed a suit claiming $10,000 in damages from his accusers. Half was for false imprisonment and half for slander by Ernst. After that trial, it was so bad that Ernst fled the state and moved his family to Missouri.
At the same time, Sheriff Pence hired a detective, Barney Schultz, from Pinkerton, Illinois, who spent 4 weeks in Marshall County studying the murder. Barney Schultz also worked on a case in O'Brien County, so maybe you'll hear about that one in the future. But from the beginning, authorities assumed Annie was killed by a male. Even newspaper headlines accused the murderer of being male. However, Barney Schultz believed she was killed by a woman named Emily Bennett. Schultz interrogated Emily and took her hair from her head to compare it to what was found clasped in Annie's hand when she died. After Schultz left the interrogation, it was reported that Emily was highly agitated. She talked about Schultz while scraping the table in front of her with her nails. When she got up to stand, her knees buckled. Others noticed she was absent-minded, preoccupied, distressed, and sleepless. Emily had spoken of Annie before, saying that she did things, quote, a good girl would not think of doing, and she rode every young fellow to death nearly that she went with.
On November 9th, a Marshall County grand jury issued an indictment against Emily Bennett for the murder of Anna Weiss. She was arrested at her farm. This is according to the Cedar Rapids Evening Gazette. Quote, Mrs. Bennett is an unprepossessing woman, perhaps 45 years of age. She and her husband have lived in that vicinity for several years. They have not enjoyed popularity among their neighbors, but nothing particularly to their discredit has been known in the past. Mrs. Bennett has been regarded as a rough, mannish sort of woman, capable of desperate deeds, perhaps like some woman under the sway of strong passion. Unquote. So just more things, more information about Emily Bennett. She was born Emily Winters Gardner in 1844 in Kane County, Illinois. She has a twin sister, fun fact. She married George Sherlock in 1866 at the age of 22. They briefly lived in Nebraska, where they had their son Arthur D. Sherlock. Then the Sherlocks moved to Marshall County, Iowa. In 1879, William Sherlock died. There were rumors that Emily killed him and hid his body in an old well. The Rock Valley Register reported, quote, not much can be learned of Sherlock's death, but it is stated that he either was murdered or committed suicide, unquote. Emily lived with her twin sister for a while after William's death in Eden County. She worked as hired help to support herself and her son. And then in January of 1886, Emily married Cyrus A., or Cy, Bennett, a man 9 years her junior, after knowing him for just 6 months. On her marriage license, it said she was 36 when she was actually 43.
I'm just going to throw a random theory in here, but was it the twin sister?
Oh my God. I didn't even think about that.
No idea, but who knows. Anyway, after Emily's arrest, the Esterville Daily News wrote, quote, Mrs. Bennett bears up remarkably well under the terrible strain, is calm, self-possessed, and frigid in her demeanor. All hope of her confessing has perished. She is noncommittal and obstinate in defiance. Scores of women visit her daily in the jail, but she screens herself behind a newspaper and will converse with no one. She utterly refuses to talk of the crime, even with her most intimate friends, and it is evident that her wonderful nerve will be sufficient to sustain her through the greatest ordeal of her life.
So at that time, Emily thought that she had typhoid fever, but officials determined nothing wrong with her body, and the officials called it a nervous breakdown. She claimed she was ill throughout her trial and while she was in jail. During this time, she hired Oliver L. and Ernest Fawcett Binford as her legal team.
On November 14th, people packed the courthouse, but Emily's attorneys pleaded not guilty on her behalf and she didn't appear at all. They argued for bail because the indictment did not specify first-degree murder, only murder generally, which, therefore, was not a capital offense. They argued that Emily's poor health made confinement an unnecessary cruelty. Judge S.A. Weaver ordered Emily Bennett held on a $10,000 bail, which the community assumed her family would not be able to make. However, she posted the bond after 23 people, including Annie's employer, Henry Russey, and her acquaintance Thomas Lowe, as well as Emily's husband and son, put up the money. The Cedar Rapids Evening Gazette described the scene, quote, Emily Bennett received the news with singular indifference, in appearance at least. Scarcely a muscle in her face moved. She showed no joy, no elation, no excitement, and acted as if the whole thing was as natural as eating a breakfast. She put on her wraps and went away with her husband, driving out immediately to their home near the scene of the murder of which Mrs. Bennett is accused.
So there was a lot of criticism from the community to those who helped with the bail. The bondsman issued this statement, quote, We, the undersigned bondsmen of Mrs. Emily Bennett, who is under indictment for the murder of Anna Weiss, hearing that certain rumors were current, namely, that we, as bondsmen, in signing her bond, virtually said that we believed in the innocence of the defendant, and by our actions in the matter were to a certain degree shielding defendant. We, and each of us, say that the question of guilt of innocence of defendant was not taken into consideration, the facts of which we know nothing about. But as the court had said that the defendant could be admitted to bail, our action followed merely as that of friends and neighbors. We stand on neutral ground and want to see justice meted out to defendant, whether innocent or guilty. However, a few months later, 11 of the 23 bondsmen demanded release from her bond partially because of all the backlash from the community, which invalidated it. She was then committed back to jail to await trial.
Most, if not all, the evidence during the trial was circumstantial. The rumored motive was that Emily thought Annie was exerting an immoral influence on her son, Arthur Sherlock, causing him to stray away from a good girl he had courted for 2 years. Some other theories included that Emily Bennett thought her husband, Cyrus, paid Annie too much attention, or that Annie knew the Bennetts killed someone who lived on their farm a few years before and was about to tell authorities.
Lots of crazy rumors in this story. So then in early January, Obed Caswell announced that Annie's body would be dug up again. He hired Maurice Ricker, a science teacher at Marshalltown High School, to take samples of Annie's hair. A prominent businessman who was there but wanted to remain anonymous told the Evening Republican, quote, I helped take up the body, pushed the glass lid of the casket partway back, and assisted Mr. Ricker in getting samples of the dead girl's hair. Just as we were about to close the coffin again, I discovered a bunch of hair in her right hand, which was clasped over the left of her breast. There was white mold, fully a quarter of an inch thick, adhering to the face, hands, and all exposed parts of the flesh. The hair, however, was free from this grave mold. That in her hand stood up in a sort of loop or bow above the second finger, and the ends were between and apparently under the index and third fingers. I called Mr. Ricker's attention to it and asked if we hadn't better bring it along with us. He said it might be well to do so. I then reached under the glass and took the hair from the hand. It pulled as if being partially grasped or inserted under the fingers. I handed it to Mr. Ricker, who put it in an envelope and marked it, "Here in hand," and haven't seen it since. The hair was about 4 inches in length. The hair found in Anna's hand during the exhumation was dark and coarse like a man's hair, completely different from the fine auburn hairs originally found. Peter Ben Dixon and others who prepared the body for burial swore on the stand that there was no hair in her hands when she was placed in her coffin, which led to rumors that Obed Caswell, Emily's lawyer, paid someone to dig Annie up, place the dark hair in her hands, and rebury her, only for him to dig it up again. Annie's body was exhumed at least 4 times, and it was reported that these were without the consent of her family.
So the trial officially began in early April of 1894. Judge D.R. Hindman presided on the case. About 100 people were called for the jury pool, and nearly 100 witnesses were subpoenaed. The final jury consisted of almost all farmers. Emily was dressed in a black, loose-fitting dress with a gold-plated brooch at the throat and wore an unadorned brown straw hat with a narrow, straight brim and flat crown.
The prosecution's case was built on the premise that Emily Bennett murdered Annie because she believed the girl had an, quote, undue intimacy with her son Arthur Sherlock and possibly with her husband Cyrus. In the opening statement, prosecutors made these accusations against Emily. 1. That Annie and Emily were acquainted. The Weiss family had lived near the Bennetts for 4 years before relocating in the spring of 1893. 2. On one visit to the Bennetts, Annie was introduced to Bert Eisenhart. When he showed interest in Annie afterwards, Emily Bennett warned him that Annie was of, quote, immoral character. 3. The Sunday before the murder, Annie was in the kitchen of the Bennett home with Emily's son, Arthur Sherlock. From the parlor, Emily overheard Annie tell him about sexual matters in a manner that was not proper for an unmarried girl. 4. Emily started rumors that Annie was immoral and was also pregnant. 5. Emily knew Annie's habit of visiting the hill farm in the evening, as well as her route to get there. 6. The night of the murder, Emily's son, Arthur, went to Green Mountain for the family's mail, and she suspected he might meet Annie clandestinely. Okay, number 7. Emily dressed in men's clothes, walked northwest through the cow yard and through a grove, where there were many sticks similar to the one used to kill Annie, passed through a cornfield and the slough, and hid in the tall grass midway between the hill and Russie Farms on the east side of the fence. When Annie came along, she attacked her. Again, this is what the prosecution's saying. So number 8, tracks were found leading from the murder scene to the Bennett home. Number 9, when Emily entered her house, she left bloodstains on a doorknob and elsewhere. Number 10, the bottom button of Emily's blouse was loosened during the struggle with Annie and fell off, and was found by law enforcement 20 rods from the scene of the murder at a midway point from there and the Bennett home. Emily sewed a metal one in its place. 11. The blouse, which bore bloodstains confirmed by scientific tests, was hidden in a trunk. 12. Dr. Cassius C. Cottle testified that scrapings from under Annie's nails matched fibers from Emily Bennett's blue blouse. 13. Dr. Cottle said the hair from Annie's head did not match what was in her hand. 14. Hair from 17 people living in the area was examined microscopically by Professor Walter S. Haynes of Rush Medical College in Chicago and compared to what Annie clutched in her hand. Only Emily Bennett's reddish hair matched in type, texture, and color. 15. The club used to strike Annie matched soft maple trees and branches compared to what was on the Bennett farm. No other neighbor had such trees. Number 16. Annie's mother, Mary Weiss, testified that Emily came to her house before the murder and complained that Annie never visited the Bennetts anymore. Annie told Emily that Arthur Sherlock was mad at her. Emily kissed Mary Weiss for the first time the day after the murder when she viewed the body. She was appalled by the throat gash and said it would require a strong-nerved person to do it. Emily told her the last thing she heard Annie say was goodnight when she passed by the Bennett farm on the Sunday before the murder and would not come in when invited. And finally, number 17, Emily had done her best to ensure the arrest of Albert Eisenhart for Annie's murder to take suspicion off of herself. When she learned he was arrested and might be lynched, she urged her son Arthur to go into town and witness the execution so he could see what happened to bad people. She herself was eager to witness it also.
The opening statements of the defense included that Emily Bennett was 50 years old and weighed only 120 pounds, while Annie was athletic and 5'11", so the argument that Emily would win in a fight against Annie is thin. Emily's left arm was out of its socket and had been since she was young and played crack the whip, which I'm not sure what that is, Beth, if you are. Must be a fun game from the 1800s. But she was unable to raise her left hand to her head in a way that would have been necessary to kill Annie. There were also bloodstains on the fences from dehorning cattle, not from the murder. John and Annie Hopper were at the Bennett farm the day of the murder to gather cherries, and the stains believed to be blood in their home and on Emily's clothes were actually cherry juice. Emily was also not concerned about Annie's influence on Bert Eisenhart. She warned Annie away from Eisenhart after he beat and injured a colt, telling her for her own good that a man who would abuse an animal would also abuse his wife. Tests showed that blood on a hand would dry within the 10 minutes it took to run from the crime scene to the Bennett house. Therefore, bloodstains could not have been left there. And finally, Annie Weiss's own parents thought Emily was innocent.
Testimony ended on Saturday, April 14th. Emily did not testify. Closing statements took until April 20th. The jury deliberated for 40 hours. One of the most forceful men on the jury, Henry Desch, collapsed while jurors were eating breakfast with stomach convulsions and bleeding from the bowels. His pain was excruciating and he could not continue to serve. So Judge Hindman dismissed the jury, ending the trial.
On September 6, 1894, Emily Bennett's second trial for murdering Annie began. Judge S.A. Weaver presided, and the second trial was very similar to the first. The motive, once again, was said to be Emily's, quote, jealousy, and there were just a few changes. So the first being Dr. Irving J. Smith, the professor of pathology and histology at the State Agriculture College in Ames, testified that there was no difference in Annie's and Emily's hair, and it was impossible to identify a particular person's hair by color or other characteristics. Another witness, Dr. Thomas Taylor, a government microscopist from Washington, D.C., also testified that it was impossible to tell the hairs matched those of Emily Bennett. And the second change was Emily herself testified at this trial. She was questioned for 2 hours, but did not contradict herself and didn't show much emotion.
The jury deliberated for 5 hours and voted 4 times. On the fourth and last vote, they all voted for acquittal. When asked how she managed to stay so cool and calm at the verdict, Emily Bennett said, "Why shouldn't I be?"
It was said that most of the public believed that Emily was guilty after the 2 trials, even though she was acquitted. Most people thought that Emily should be convicted of second-degree murder, and many speculated she waited to threaten and lecture Annie, but became angry and lost control. Others suggested she did not act alone. Rumors that her husband or son helped her swirled.
After the trial, Emily and Cyrus Bennett returned to their farm and stayed in the county for a number of years. In 1910, the Bennetts lived in Bremen, Wells County, North Dakota. By 1920, they had moved to Twin Falls, Idaho, to live with their son, Arthur, his wife, Estella, and their children. Emily died February 27, 1925, in Twin Falls at age 80. Cyrus Bennett's date of death is unknown. Arthur Sherlock and Estella Simmons had 5 children, Nora, Mary, Howard, Alma, and Helena. In 1944, he died at age 76 in Twin Falls.
In the summer of 1894, Marshall County citizens raised money to place a granite monument over Annie's grave in the Vienna Cemetery at Beeman with this inscription: "In memory of Anna Weiss, foully murdered, August 26, 1893, aged 20 years, 2 months, 15 days, erected by generous and sympathizing friends, vengeance is mine, saith the Lord." So it's a long shot, but if anyone knows anything about the case, please contact the Iowa Department of Criminal Investigation. All right, Beth, I think we have a lot of questions for Taps. Are you ready to give him a call?
Yes, ma'am. Let's do it. Hello, Taps. Thank you for joining us.
Hello.
We are in Marshall County today. So, have you been?
Many times. Highway 30 goes through Marshall County. Marshalltown is in Marshall County. Yes, I've been there many times.
Beth has a fun fact about Marshalltown and someone from it.
Oh my God, yeah, the Top Gun Maverick director. Have you seen that movie?
I have not.
Well, it's getting rave reviews. I haven't seen it either, but it's on my list. Yeah, the director of that movie is from Marshalltown. Well, this episode. So, for example, in this story, the public was allowed to exhume the body because they kind of opened it up for anyone to investigate. So what are the limitations now of how the public can try and contribute to an investigation?
I mean, obviously the public contributes to investigation through witnesses and things of that, but to exhume a body, unheard of. I mean, you have to have a court order to do that today. I mean, it just, that was so bizarre that it goes beyond bizarre.
All right. You've often said that violent murders against women are usually committed by men. Thoughts on this one?
After reading everything, and again, we don't know lots about what happened, but just what I have read, it is hard for me to believe that a woman committed this murder. First of all, the violence of the attack, the strength and penetration of the throat nearly to the spinal cord does not typically from a female suspect.
Do you agree with the statement that pulling hair and scratches would be two women fighting?
No, not at all. And those are what happen in any kind of fight. You're grabbing for whatever you can grab. You're clawing for whatever you can claw. I don't believe this woman committed this murder.
Too many guesses who?
Well, my first was the guy that had the great alibi. Because of the violence done to her, somebody that really didn't like her really wanted to commit violence against her. The number of stab wounds, the way the head was nearly severed, that's somebody that's got great anger. So that would be my guy. It would be interesting to know how solid the alibi was.
So like nowadays, let's say you present that alibi, but there are scratches on this woman. Could they have been, I don't know, looked at, like, you know how you can find things under the fingertips?
Oh yeah, we would clip fingernails on a suspect.
Would they have been a suspect? Could you gather those even with the alibi?
If you had the probable cause to get the search warrant.
Okay.
And then you'd have hair.
Right.
And you might be able to get DNA off the hair follicles. You can't get necessarily DNA off hair, but you can get it off the follicles, the roots. So there might've been a possibility of that. But again, we're talking about none of this technology had been invented yet.
Right. Yeah, no.
Great segue into my next question. Any idea if you would actually be able to tell whose hair was whose back in 1894?
Well, it sounds like they were just giving it to random people to look under microscopes and things like that. If you could pull a blood type from the follicle, you might have been able to do that. But again, I don't know the technology available to do that back then. But a good microscope, you would think that they could identify at least the color and the tint.
Yeah, they said even that was like sort of iffy though.
Okay, one more time. When did fingerprints become a thing?
I think it was in the late 1800s. The French, there were some French people and some other people that were looking at head shapes for identification. And then the fingerprints occurred shortly thereafter. So I want to say like in the 1870s or 80s, but there was not much of a library of prints. You know, Today we have APHIS and all these machines that can draw all these comparisons from all over the world. Back then, the stuff was all done in file cabinets with a classification system. I think it was the Henry classification system, something like that, where they classified fingerprints from the whorls and swirls and things that are on the prints.
So wouldn't they have been able to compare the palm prints on the fence to Emily's palm print?
If they had the technology. But who would, do you think they even pulled the prints off anything? They just probably looked and saw a palm print, but do you think it was preserved in any way?
I'm sure not.
So yeah, I think we're dealing with a rural 19th century Iowa sheriff that the best he could do was question people.
So a couple jurors became ill in this case. What happens now if a juror gets sick?
In major cases, the judge usually impanels 14 jurors in every case so that there are alternates. And if somebody falls out, the alternate becomes a primary juror.
Were you suspicious that two jurors like keeled over.
Well, the one guy sounded like he was really sick. I don't know. Yeah. It's hard to say.
Ooh, okay. This next question is very relevant right now because I'm watching The Staircase. But our question was,
is The Staircase behind you or where's it at?
No, you should watch it. It's really good.
The Staircase? Do you see like your neighbors come up it?
No, it's this guy who...
Oh, you're talking about like a TV show or something.
It's a TV show.
I thought you were talking about The Staircase.
It's called The Staircase. What?
I thought you were talking about The Staircase like in your apartment. People walk up and down.
This is no. Like that Fox News, like you situation.
Yes. The Staircase is about this guy who maybe did not kill his wife. But the crazy thing is that they found out that this is the second person who has died down a staircase that has been in his life under mysterious circumstances. So our question was, does a family have to consent to a relative's body being exhumed?
Usually, yes.
Okay, so in The Staircase, it's interesting because they have stepkids, but then she had one daughter who was actually hers, and only that daughter's opinion was taken into consideration, not the stepchildren.
Go to the coroner and try to get a judge's order to exhume the body. The problem is that what we do to bodies to prepare them for burial pretty much destroys a lot of the evidence.
Well, and nowadays, like cremation is almost just as big as burial, so.
And obviously that destroys the evidence.
Yeah.
What are the repercussions for manufacturing evidence?
It's a crime. Yeah. Depending on, you know, the purposes and reasons you did it and things, but yeah, you could be arrested. It's a felony.
All right. And finally, do you think Emily murdered Annie? And if not Emily, who?
Well, I don't think she did, but I don't know if you could say who did, because obviously the guy that I was thinking of allegedly had this alibi. So I would like to know how strong the alibi was.
Are those your final thoughts, or do you want to add anything?
No, tragic, terrible, you know, young girl, brutally murdered. It's just very sad.
Agreed.
Yeah. Super senseless.
All right.
Well, thank you for joining. We'll talk to you next time.
Okay.
Oh, hello there. As a marketer, I hate promotions like this.
Same and same.
But I love content.
Me too.
So if you like our content, give us a like, follow, share, subscribe, note, fax, literally anything you think would help us continue making Daiwa a success.
Thank you.